everyone. We're going to get started. This is our last lecture. We're going to be talking about stuff that's beyond engineering. How can we go further from engineering? And there's a homework due today. If you guys have any questions about it, I'm going to close the date. So, Onsaka, I don't know if you noticed this, but there's a deadline, and then you can submit the homework late for a week. This time, you can't really submit it. You can't submit it until tomorrow. So if you haven't submitted it, please submit it. There's going to be a little penalty for submitting late, but you won't be able to submit it much later than that because we need to grade it and before the final. And the final is a week from tomorrow. And I hope you all know that. All right, so if you guys have any questions about homework six, I'm a little behind. All right. I'm going to be going over the final sample next time, so bring your questions. I'm also planning to make solutions for the final sample, so those should be out by maybe tomorrow or Friday. So, you know, I definitely recommend trying to solve the final yourself, try to work all those problems yourself, and then, you know, check them with the solutions. Also, I sent out an email. There's going to be a review sessions next week. I reserved a room on Tuesday and Wednesday between 1 and 5 p.m. So if you're planning to come, please let me know so I don't just sit there. Please let me know if you're planning to come and when. And so you don't have to stay the whole time. You can just come, ask a question, leave. It doesn't matter. Those are kind of like office hours for a lot of people. Can you please go over number 3? Okay, and I can do it on the board. If there's 15 people, that's great. If there's 2 people, that's great. If there's nobody, that's not great. So, 1 or more, at least. 1 is great, but I don't really like to talk to the walls. So, all right? Any questions about that? Okay, so last time, Michael Littman gave the lecture. I hope you guys enjoyed it. I heard there were some problems with the clicker questions, for which I apologize. Last question, there's some problems with it. Anyway, yeah.
The lecture behind the lecture, is it available?
Yes, I will post the slides too, yeah. Yep, I'm going to go over real quick some of the issues that he talked about, hopefully he covered. But those slides will be online. And that's kind of the area of our research. Michael talked to you guys about machine learning last time, and that was the conference that I went to. It was about machine learning, and it's very cool to see the latest research. There are 2 things that I really liked. One project was this person made a wheelchair for people with dementia, and the wheelchair kind of figures out if you're kind of confused. He kind of asks you questions and gets feedback from you and also talks to you. So it does stuff like, if it knows where you want to go and then you forgot where you want to go, you can ask it and it tells you this is what you're going to do. So I thought it was very cool. It's very helpful for people in nursing homes and stuff like that. Another person did measuring electrical signals on newborn babies and kind of trying to predict if the electrical activity of the heart is this way, they're going to need more help. If the electrical activity of the heart is this other way, they're not going to need that much help. So kind of, take these babies and take care of them more because they might die if you don't take care of them. So that was cool too. So it's very cool to see that, computers can really help, maybe not, cure cancer or whatever, but just have some kind of contribution to, helping, saving babies or, old people. Yes, Eric. That's true. So Michael actually has a project that purpose is to cure cancer or to help cure cancer. So anyway, just to see that, the computers are not just like an isolated thing that, I don't know how many of you enjoy this class, how many of you think computer science is interesting, but they definitely have their own, area where they're helpful and interesting. All right, so I'm going to dive into a little recap about last time. This has been the kind of the idea of an algorithm that we've been talking about. The algorithm is a method. It's a black box. There's some inputs going in. There's some outputs coming out, and there's steps to do it. So the inputs can be like some kind of list, for example. And the output can be a yes, no. Does the list contain number 49 or does it not contain number 49? And the algorithm actually gives you step one, step two. Okay, you go to the first element of the list. You check if it's 49. Step two, you go to the second element of the list. You check if it's 49 and so on. So it's very, it's the method of solving a problem. And what machine learning does, what it adds to it, is this idea of experience. So you have not just the stuff that's going in, the stuff that's coming out, but there's some kind of experience that the algorithm uses. And that experience, in, for example, in supervised learning, is a whole bunch of examples with their labels. So this is a classifier, right? We want, you know, example one is a good example. So one example classifier is, people might use it when they admissions to college, right? So they have, the example would be a student, their data, their GPA in high school, their SAT scores, and so on, and if they're going to be admitted or not. So there's a whole training set, and the training set can say, this is, you know, this is a student, this was their data, and they did well. You know, maybe another student, this was their data, they didn't do well. And they try to use that experience to try to predict when somebody new is coming in, when a new student is applying to college, are they going to do well or are they not going to do well? Is it worth giving them a scholarship or is it not worth giving them a scholarship? And so that's what the classifiers do. One really cool example of a classifier that I thought was worth mentioning, I don't know if Michael talked about this, is the idea of rating systems, right? For example, on Netflix. Netflix is, you know, you rent movies, you either like them or not, but they have this recommendation system. And they want to know, they want to make good recommendations for you. So the idea is that they kind of make groups of users based on their same taste. So these people, they all like the same kinds of movies. This is the group of, I don't know, science fiction people. This is a group of, you know, old historical movies. So they group the users together, and then knowing that one group likes Finding Nemo, one person in one group likes Finding Nemo, is this other person in the group gonna like Finding Nemo? So should I recommend that movie to the new person? And so they had this, the Netflix Prize, you might have heard, you know, it was in the news. The idea was that, so Netflix is trying to predict what movie should we recommend to whom, and, you know, what is the rating going to be? Is this user going to like it, or is it not, or are they not going to like it? And so there's this huge, huge table, 100 million, the data that was available was 100 million pieces of the data, with so this huge matrix that all the movies on the columns and the users, and then what rating the user gave to each movie. And so they said that whoever is going to do better than their predictor, the predictor that they have, by 10%, so it's going to be better than their predictor by 10%, they're going to win $1 million. And so they didn't know how much time to give to people, so they just said, you know, just solve the problem. And there's this really cool story about, the rule was that once they did the 10% better than their classifier, there was a time when other people could submit their solutions, and then those solutions would compete too. So these people went over 10%, and then the second, third, so a few bunch of people who did well but not the best, kind of made a whole team and went against the people who were on the first place. It ended up that the people who were first actually won. The team that was made of all the other people, they had the same exact score, but they submitted a little later, 20 minutes later. So the first team won it by 20 minutes, basically. So that was very a pretty intense story. Another idea that hopefully Michael touched was this idea of forever loop. So we looked at the halting problem, and we said that we don't like stuff that doesn't end. We don't like stuff that goes in loop forever. But in some cases, we might like, we need programs that run forever. And one example was an operating system, right? You don't just want your operating system to just shut down without letting you know. you want them to run forever and wait for you to click on something or to search for something. You want the operating system to keep in a forever loop and ask you for feedback. All kinds of user interfaces, video games are forever loops. They keep waiting for feedback from you and changing the game. Robots are forever loops. Thermostats are forever loops. And then also this idea of another idea of reinforcement learning, which is you don't really tell a computer exactly what to do step by step, but you try to motivate it. You try to give it a goal, and when it gets to a certain state, you kind of give it a reward. So, for example, the Aibo, the robot, maybe you wanted to go to the ball. There's a whole a lot of teams make have robot soccer, so you know, there's all these little robot dogs that play soccer together. So one of the goals might be you want the robot to go to the ball and so it can hit the ball in the end of the goal. So you might reward it, you might give it some kind of positive reinforcement when it sees the ball. There's this problem that's called mountain car, which is a car that needs to go up on a hill and then you give it the little star as a bonus when it gets up the hill, and so on. So this is the idea of reinforcement. If you want to train a dog, a robot dog, to be to go to the ball, it gets a positive reinforcement when it sees the ball, and then it's probably going to get a bigger reinforcement when it hits the ball. But then it doesn't have to run around too much, right? So you care if the ball is here and the robot is here, you don't want the robot to go around the room and maybe to the other room and then come back and hit the ball. You want the robot to hit the ball as fast as possible. So then you give it a negative reinforcement for each step that it's taking. That kind of translates into it uses a little battery for moving to the ball. So you want to keep that as small as possible. And so with that, you kind of drive the behavior of the robot. And it always chooses, you program it to choose its action to maximize the whole reward that it's getting. So positive reward minus negative reward, that has to be as big as possible. Okay, so today we're going to be talking about genetic algorithms. The people thought, okay, well, there's this theory of evolution, right? What if we make an algorithm that follows that theory? What if our method is just the theory of evolution? And so they took the theory and said, instead of engineering something, instead of making a sorting algorithm by, you know, step one, you compare the first two elements. Step two, you compare the next two elements, and so on. You kind of make a whole bunch of programs and help them evolve according to certain rules. And we're going to see how that works. So, that doesn't say that, you know, that's how things actually work in nature, but it's just an idea, and so you wanna try to implement that. So the inspiration is the brain, right? The brain is a huge computer, some people would say. It has built millions of connections. Every neuron has about 100,000 connections. And there's a specialized area, and people look at the brain and say, there are specialized areas, but sometimes if you damage an area, other areas take over. So they don't see this clean, like, structure in the brain, which some people interpret as maybe it doesn't have this clean structure, but some people say, well, maybe the structure is too complicated for us to understand. So we don't really know exactly where the brain is too complex for us to understand at this point, but we would like to use it because natural things, the brain is such a robust system, right? If you fall on your head, you might damage it a little bit, but you're kind of okay. You can still end up being okay. Whereas if you damage a computer, if you drop your computer, on the ground, or if you throw it off the window, it's not gonna work anymore. So that's what drove people to try to use this approach. So yeah, the brain has in some ways there's an area that deals with colors, some area that deals with speech, an area that kind of translates between concepts and words. There's all these different areas. And if you compare a computer to a brain, you can see that there are pretty big differences. Something like, you know, if you damage a computer, if a computer runs out of battery, it will not be able to function, right? There's the smallest thing that goes wrong with a computer is going to make it not function. But some parts of the brain, if you damage them, the brain can still continue working. So it's this idea of robustness. Also, the computer has this very, you know, if you look at a circuit, there's the area that deals with the mathematical function, there's the area of the memory, and we saw this kind of very clean structure. But we know that certain areas of the brain have certain functions, but we don't exactly know exactly the wiring. So people have tried, this is probably can't see it very well, but they try to make the same kind of structure, hierarchical structure, in a computer to translate it to a brain. And the little rectangles are kind of the areas of the brain. And then they try to make this hierarchy. And you can see how many connections there are. And that's probably part of why it works so well and it's so robust. And you know, of course, this is a simplification and people don't really understand a brain. But so, you know, some people would say that the brain has a very different structure from the artificial intelligence engineered systems. So it's kind of hard if we want to understand intelligence. Maybe we shouldn't try to break it apart and I don't know, try to figure out exactly what the algorithm is for each thing. Let's just try to evolve it, right? Another problem is that if you look at what people do. I'm going to skip this. This is about segways. Does everybody know what a segway is? It's that like huge. I think it has a one like. Okay, maybe I should look at this. Well, anyway, they try to replace bikes with segways, and there's a lot of accidents. And this is a video of somebody falling off a segway. They're very unstable. There's been a lot of engineering failures, right? People try to build something and they mess up. Some of the biggest ones are, there is a radiation treatment machine. When the user would type up too fast, the machine would overdose the patient and the patient would die instead of, you know, being cured. So that's a problem. Another thing is that there's a, you know, for weapons. So some people use, you know, tenths of a second. Oh yeah, right. So if the time is measured in tenths of a second, then if you have binary, you only have this much precision. So it can make a difference between, you know, how much time you, like a small difference in time is very important, and computers can only capture this many units of time. There's all kinds of things like, yeah, feet and meters, like, you know, engineers that work together from the United States and Europe or Canada. Some people say measure stuff in feet, some people measure stuff in meters. 1 foot is not equal to 1 meter, and so that's, you know, that's a problem. They actually lost a Mars little satellite that they're trying to go to Mars, and they missed because of that. And, you know, things like that. So people make amazing things, they go to space. But we make these stupid little mistakes in the way we engineer stuff, and they cost us, pretty expensive equipment and stuff like that. It seems to me that things like that don't happen in nature. So, you know, as we say, well, how can we get inspiration from that? Well, let's just try to see what genetic algorithms are going to do. So, we're going to try to use genetic algorithms. So how does this work? Okay. Let's say the problem we have is sorting a list. And let's say your list is 692584. The way we've done it so far, and these are the codes that I showed you before in Scratch, we have this very structured method, right? We take each element of the list and we repeat the length of the deck. We find the smallest element, this is selection sort, find the smallest element, put the smallest element as the first element in the sorted list. Find the next smallest element, put the second smallest element in the list, and so on, right? So the method of, you know, very systematically, we know exactly what this does. We can look at this code, see what it's doing. That's our approach. So let's try a different approach. What if we created, so given the set of instructions that we work with, machine language, right? Let's create 10,000 random programs. So just take instructions, mix them up randomly, make 10,000 programs, and then try to give each program the list and see what it does with it, right? And most of them do random things, so they're going to be pretty bad at it. But we're coming up with a score. We're going to say, okay, how does each program do? And the way we score this, for example, we can do, we know the sorted list, what it looks like. We're going to count how many elements in the list that are, let's say this is the list that our program sorted, our random program sorted. How many elements are in the spot where they're supposed to be? So in this case, it's just 8 is in the right position, and we're going to give it a score of 1, right? So we create 10,000 random ones, we score each one of them, then we delete the bottom half, the programs that do worse than average, we throw them away. And then we combine the remaining programs to replace the ones we deleted. Okay, so this is kind of simulating the whole mutation crossover process. So this is our summary. This is what we're going to do. This is going to be our method. Okay. So a little bit of terminology in genetic algorithms. The 10,000 programs are called individuals. That's what we're going to call them. The score is called a fitness function. So, you know, what's the fitness function? The fitness function is how many elements are in the right spot in the sorted list. The third one is delete all programs. That's called selection. And the combination of the remaining programs to replace the ones that we deleted is called crossover. So, and then sometimes after the crossover, we slightly change some of the individuals. We might change a bit or two. So if you, if we were to put all the steps in one slide, let's say our population, our individuals, our random programs are these. And we said that everything in the computer is just a sequence of bits. The instructions, even we said that we can take an instruction and turn it into a 7-bit code. So let's say these are our programs, a whole bunch of bits, with the interpretation that they're the solution to our problem. We have 10,000 solutions to the problem. In this case, we have 3. We evaluate each of them, and let's say they get these scores. The first one gets 13, the second one 96, and the third one 41. And then the bottom half, we're going to delete the first one because it just has a small score. So we don't need it. We're going to leave the two that had a higher score. And then we do the crossover by taking these two, for example, and wherever the bits match, bitwise, wherever the bits match, if it's this bit matches, that's going to get copied into the child. This bit matches is going to be copied. If the bits don't match, randomly choose between the two individuals. So in this case, we choose this bit. In this case, we choose this bit, and so on. So that's how we create the new, that's how we make the crossover. Mutation says, okay, I'm just going to choose a random bit for this individual and make it, instead of a 0, I'm going to change it to a 1, randomly too. And so I have these guys now, and the next generation, that they're going to be the next part of the next generation. And then I'm going to repeat this over and over and over again. So this is how you, a way to solve a problem, right? You just apply this, you know, evolution to your problem. And so when you use genetic algorithms to solve a problem, what you have to decide is just a few things. You have to decide what's the fitness function, how are you going to score your solutions, how do you represent individuals. For example, if you have a sorting algorithm, you're going to they're going to be a sequences of instructions. How are the individuals selected for reproduction? You know, maybe the bottom, the top half, the ones that have done the best, or however you want to do it. How are you doing mutation and how are you doing crossover? So if you decide these things, you just throw into the genetic algorithm. Imagine it's a, like a big box, black box, and it comes up with your solution. So most of the time, the solution of a genetic algorithm is the second best. Is seen as the second best solution to a problem. And so what you do if you were to write a program, you make the initial random population, you sort the individual by fitness, and you delete the bottom half, and then you miss the missing half, the ones that you deleted, you replace with a new individual created via crossover. And then you just select a random bit to mutate, to change the individuals that you already have. So this is cool because it uses almost everything that we talked about in this class. It uses loops, it uses sorting, you have to sort them to select the best ones. It uses bits because that's how you represent your individuals. There's, you know, graph search, and so on. And you can do a lot of things in parallel. Okay, so one person who actually applied and made a visual video, I'm going to show you the video of this, the problem is Carl Sims. And what he did was, okay, he created these artificial environments, underwater or on the ground, and he created these creatures made out of cubes. And he simulated, you know, the forces that would happen in those environments. So they look like little cubes moving around. And the fitness was, at each time, in each environment, he chose a fitness. For example, which creature would swim faster, or which creature would run faster. But again, the creatures are bound by their shape. And so I'm going to show you the video. It's kind of funny, actually. Let's see if this works. Let me, I'm going to pause it because he has some comments. And try to find this. So they each have individual fitness functions. So, I thought that was very interesting. And it's very, the first time I saw this, I was like, wow, that's great. But that was in 1994, and nothing happened after that. So, the problem is that they kind of, you can't improve them. You can't improve the genetic algorithm. The best you can do is just throw away the worst, and keep the best, and kind of train them. And it's kind of that field is kind of stuck. It looked very promising, but it kind of died. Maybe it's gaining a little bit of popularity now again because they're very fast. They're very fast methods. And so, yeah. Any comments, questions on that? All right. So again, whatever we want of an algorithm, when we solve a problem, we can encode it in the fitness function. If we want something that sorts fast, we can just give it a higher score if it sorts fast. The ones that sort fast are good, the ones that don't sort fast are not good. So they're also faster than any of the sorting problems. They solve the problem faster than any of the sorting problems that we learn about. So how, if they're faster, what do they do, right? So if we make a program that sorts, a genetic algorithm that sorts a list, how does it do it? We can just look at the instructions, right, and see exactly what the genetic algorithms came with. So this is, again, starting with our scratch-like, engineered method, and the problem is that we can't understand what the genetic algorithm is doing. So I actually didn't do it. I took it from a book. Somebody actually made a genetic algorithm that sorts a list. You look at the instructions and it doesn't make any sense. You don't really understand. It's not like a systematic thing that you can understand. It's just chaos and it creates a sorted list. So Another observation I thought was interesting was that even though we don't know a lot about the biological world, there is this kind of structure in the cell, for example. And there is structure in the brain. There is structure, it's just that it's too complex for us to understand. And maybe one day we'll be able to understand our genetic algorithm and engineered programs too. So that being said, that was the genetic algorithm's idea. I'd like to do a review, but let's see. We're going to do clicker questions before, and then I'm going to go into a review about kind of what have we been talking about and what are the skills that I hope you guys got, and let's see if I can find the clicker question. Okay, so we talked about forever loops, right? And one forever loop that's interesting and helpful to us is a thermostat. So what a thermostat does is there's a thermometer, and the thermometer is resistance A sensor value, the blue thing. There's a sensor, and that gives you a temperature. And what you do is you set the variable temperature to whatever the temperature is. So this line here sets the temperature. And then you say if the temperature is smaller than the setting, you activate the heat, right? If the temperature is bigger than the setting, you don't need to activate the heat. It's warm enough, and you don't need to do anything, right? And this is all in the forever loop. In the forever loop, it reads the temperature. If the temperature is too low, you have to activate the heat, okay? So far, so good? So this is, what's wrong with this problem? What's wrong with this code? So what I did was put a bug in the code of the thermostat. I changed it a little bit, and this program has a bug. What does it always do? So the program is when the thermostat is clicked forever, in the forever loop we have set temperature to the sensor value, and if temperature is larger than the setting, broadcast activate heat. So if the temperature is bigger than the setting, you activate the heat. Okay? And that's in the forever loop. The options are, so the bug is A, turns on the heat when it's hot. B, turns on the heat at most once. C, it leaves the heat always on or always off. D, turns off the heat at most once. E, never turns on the heat no matter what. Stop at 1:30. Stopping? All right, good. So, majority got the right answer. C is leaves the heat always on or always off. Okay. So this one, what does it do? It sets the temperature, and if it's, let's say your setting, your comfortable temperature is 70 degrees. If the temperature is 80 degrees, if the temperature is larger than setting, you activate the heat, right? Which is not okay. If it's summertime, if it's 100 degrees, you activate the heat. So that's the bug in this. Okay. Let's do this one. So which node is a source in this graph? A, F, B, A, C, none of them, D, D, and E, C. Stopping at 1? Maybe. since everybody voted, so I'm going to stop. All right, nice. Good job. What? Okay. Moving on. Which node is a sink in this graph? Same options. So a sink is a node that doesn't have anything that goes out of it. No, that doesn't have anything that, that goes out. And F is one of them. Okay, so this one is about lists. If you are given an unsorted list of n integers, how many operations will it take to find the biggest number? Okay, that's the first one. And what about a specific number, like 47? So they have two, for each option, you have two big O's. One is for, the first one is for the biggest number, the second one is for the specific number. And the options are A, big O of log N, and big O of N, B, big O of N, and big O of N, C, big O of N squared, and big O of log N, D, big O of 1, and big O of log N, and E, big O of N squared log N, and big O of N. Stopping at 120. Stopping? All right. Good. Any questions? Okay, so in either case, you have to go systematically through each element of the list and find either the biggest one or a certain number, 47. There's no way around that. What about if the list is sorted? Same question, how many operations will it take to find the biggest one, and how many operations will it take to find a specific number, like 47? And the options are the same. Stopping at 120. Stopping. Good. Okay. Nice. So, how do you find the biggest number? can tell me how you find the biggest number. Yeah. Yeah, you look at the last number in the list, and that's going to be the biggest one. What about 47? How would you do that? Exactly. Yep. So if you split the list in half and look in the middle, you're going to know exactly which half you need to look at, and which half you need to focus. You don't have to look through all the numbers. You can just throw away half of the list and focus on, the half of the list.
Is that why it's locked?
That's why it's locked. Yep. So looking for a number in a sorted list is big O of log. Okay. Any questions? Okay, that was it. Go back to... Okay, so, in the beginning, the first lecture, we talked about what computer science is about. We said that it's a study of reduction, that it's a study of taking complex problems and breaking them down into simpler problems, and I hope that you can see why that would be after you found out all this stuff about computer science. We took an example of reduction. We looked at barcodes and how you can go from a product, a very abstract thing, to ink, which is a very concrete, tangible thing. So the skill that I hope you got from this was barcodes. And the barcodes, we said that they're basically 11 digits of information. And the 12th digit is actually just checking to see if everything went okay, if the code that was read was okay. And we said how we can find the check digit, and that's by adding up the odd digits, multiplying them by 3, and then adding up the even digits. The number that we get, we subtract from the next multiple of 10, and that's our check digit. And so we can use this for finding any missing digit in the code. If we are given the check digit, we can find out, and we are not given one of the digits, we can find that out by just applying this rule. And there's homework about this, and that's one of the problems, I think, in the sample final too. So you can practice it if you want. Okay, so after that, we started talking about bits and how they're the unit of information for computers. Also, one thing that was cool was that you don't have to use wires and switches. That's what people use, but to make computers today. But you can use anything else that can help you encode zeros and ones, trues and falses. And we talk about Boolean algebra. We talk about how Boolean algebra is trying to encode logic, and there are operations in Boolean algebra, just like in regular algebra. There's ands and ors and nots. We learn how to do ands and ors and nots. And so I expect everybody to be able to use their tables and figure out what is A or B, A and B, and so on, if A is true and B is false or whatever. We did a whole bunch of different big expressions, and if I give you an expression, you should be able to figure out what's true and if it's true or if it's false. So if you have any questions about that, I can give you more examples. You can email me or whatever about any of this, okay? So I kind of tell you what's my expectation of your knowledge or of your skills or whatever. Then we started with ands, ors, and nots. We said that, and I showed you, that we can build any logical expression. Any Boolean expression can be made out of ands, nots, and ors. And so we can reduce that complicated expression into these very simple expressions. We took the example of the game of NIM, and where you had like 5 objects or 10 objects, and players take turns taking one or two. You win the game if you're the last one to take an object. And we made it actually out of switches and wires in Scratch. So that was an example of how you can take a game, and make it out of switches and bits and electricity. So, In this case, there's logic gates, and sometimes I give you logic gates in form of truth tables. Sometimes I give you logic gates in terms of what's inside of them, and sometimes in terms of ands and ors and nots. And you are asked to convert between those forms. We also learn about representing numbers in binary, how that works. How you can take 32 and make represent in binary. And I would like everybody to know how to go between binary and decimal, decimal and binary. We did some of that. We also learned how to add and subtract numbers in binary. Not just by converting them to decimal, but actually doing it in binary. And you can always use decimal to check your work. And we had some of that on the midterm. Okay, so then we started building up, and we're making more and more complex problems. We talked about state machines, and we showed how the computer is a very complicated state machine, which led us to the CPU, the processor, which interprets machine instruction. The memory holds the information, and then you have the arithmetic circuits that do operations very fast. And so this is the point where we got to a whole computer. So we got to, the computer is made out of all these different parts that each have their own structures. And we talked about those parts and the von Neumann architecture. We also talked about machine language. We said that at the very lowest level, programming is just a bunch of very simple instructions. And we showed that any kind of program can be made out of these very broken down into these very simple instructions. And I gave you guys a long instruction or a long Boolean expression, and then you were able to break it down into these simple instructions that can be run on a very low level on the processor. So we talked about that, and then we talked about machine language and how so each basically at each clock cycle, a whole bunch of instructions are executed, and then they go back. The data goes back into the processor, and at the next cycle, it executes other instructions and so on. And that's billions of them per second. So a machine language is just a very simple programming language made out of simple instructions, which are made out of bits. And we said that each instruction is a 7-bit instruction. And so everything in the computer can be broken down into these small instructions. And the skill was to convert a machine language program into an expression. So sometimes I say, okay, here's 10 instructions. What will be in the accumulator after this program is executed? And you see how in the accumulator you get that nice long formula made of all these simple instructions. That was on the midterm too, and I hope you still remember how to do that. And that's, I think it's also on the sample final. So some of these you can practice on the sample final. And so we talked about how there's this hierarchy, there's this idea of reduction in on the level of programming. We have the big applications are made with software libraries, which are made with high level language, which like Scratch or Java, which are broken down into machine language, which are broken down into logic blocks, ands and ors and nots, which are broken down into physical bits. So, even the most complicated application, the most complicated video game, can be made out of, at one level in the computer, it's made out of a whole bunch of bits. And we also saw how, for programming, we learned how to program Scratch. We saw how we can write subroutines with the broadcast and when I receive to make our life easier. If we have something that we want to do repeatedly, we can just write a subroutine that does that, and then we broadcast the subroutine, and we don't have to write the whole thing over again. And an idea was the songs and the choruses, or pieces in the song that repeat, we can just write them once and then just broadcast the subroutine. Okay. And also, once, I don't know if I wrote this down, but this Yeah, that was kind of the summary of what I said. The machine language is in the middle of the stack, and this is the whole reduction stack that we said. So the one thing that I didn't write here was the skill is to see a computer, a scratch script, and be able to figure out what it does. And we had that for sorting. There's all kinds of things that sometimes I use broadcast, and what will the value of this variable be at the end of this string, at the end of the script? How many times will it pop? How many times will the meow sound happen? And so on. So that's one skill that I hope you know you guys got. Okay, so this was we ended the programming part with talking about compilers and interpreters, and we talked about expression trees and how computers use expression trees, compilers use expression trees to figure out which operations need to be done first and which operations need to be done later. And this is the interpreting expression trees. If I give you an expression tree, I hope you guys can tell me what is the expression that the expression tree is encoding. And so, you know, again, the interpreter was a program that takes a program as input and makes it happen. So it basically executes the program. So if it gets this program here, which talks about this tree, it's interpreting it, it's making it happen, it evaluates the tree, and the value of this tree is true. The compiler, on the other hand, takes higher level languages like Scratch and turns it into a lower level language like machine language. And so it's basically a program that takes a program and turns it into another program. So that's kind of. And then we talked about algorithms. We had the SOC sorting. We talked about how. What does it mean that a method is better than another method? What does it mean that we want a good algorithm? What does that mean? We said that we want something that is efficient. We want something that is fast. And so, for example, you know, the SOC sorting, different SOC sorting algorithms were, some were faster, some were slower. How do we figure out which one is better? And so on. And one skill at this chapter was, if I give you a complicated gate and I tell you what it's made of, how many ORs, knots, ANDs, knots, and ORs are in that gate, right? So we had, I don't know, the odd 10 gates. The odd 10 gate is made out of five ORs and 10 XOR gates. Each XOR gate is made out of this many ANDs, this many knots, and this many ORs. And this one will be, it's also in the sample final, and it might be on the final. Speaking of methods and different methods of doing the same thing, we talked about decision problems on lists, and we had a whole class where I gave you a list of 50 numbers, and you guys had to answer the question. You know, is 90 the list? What's the median? Is this the median? And so on. We said that, we showed how there's methods that do it faster and there's methods that do it slower, and how you know, something like the median, it's so much quicker to just count how many elements are smaller than a median, how many elements are bigger than a median, than actually to sort the whole list and look in the middle. And we showed fast methods for if the sum is divisible by 5, and the product is divisible by 5. So it's good to know the fast way, so you know you can finish up the final quicker or something. But some problems are so the lists are so big that there would be no way you could finish it if you use the slow way. So yeah, make sure you know the fast way for doing them. So we also talked about the big O notation and how we can express how hard a problem is by big O notation. What's the number of operations that need to be done to solve this problem? And we kind of illustrated it by using songs and seeing how the growth, the way the song looks like, what the song looks like and how this number of syllables grows as the number of verses grow is a very good indicator of how big the song is going to be at the end. And so we have a whole bunch of, so the verse, the songs can basically be four classes. There's a big O of N kinds of songs, which means that each verse is approximately the same size, and there's no counting involved. Each verses are approximately the same size, but there's counting, like the Bottle of Beer song, the monkeys, N monkeys, and 5 Little Monkeys. That's an N log N song, because as the number of verses grows, as you have a lot of verses, the number of little monkeys, the 5 million little monkey, saying that is going to take longer. Saying a big number is going to take longer than saying a small number, so you have to factor that in. So that's why the songs that have counting have a log involved. If you have songs without counting, but where the verses grow, number of syllables grows with each verse, that's an N squared, and if you add counting to that, that's going to be N squared log N. So the skill is to, given a song, what is the growth rate of the song? And I hope that that's a little more clear than it was in the beginning. So these are the examples of songs with the constant verse size, the go of N. Each verse contains the next highest number, or the next lowest number, that's N log N. If it grows, it's N squared, and if you have counting and it grows, it's N squared. And this is a slide in your lecture notes. If you have any questions about these slides, I can tell you where they are in the lecture notes. Okay. So also another skill that I hope you have now is using the word exponential correctly. Which says that it's not just comparing two things and saying the one is much bigger than the other or much better or whatever. It's showing a trend of growth. And that's the correct use of the word exponential. And then we looked at soft sorting and kind of try to analyze how algorithms, how the soft sorting, what kind of big O they are. And so we saw that the hardest problems that we can find are NP complete problems. And one problem was, is there any set of numbers in this list that adds up to 257? So that's a very, very hard problem. It would take a long time because it's a very, very hard problem. We weren't able to solve it in class because it would take a long time to solve. And those are the NP-complete problems. We said, though, that the NP-complete problems have the property that if you're showing me a solution, it's very quick to check the solution. If you have a huge list, and one of you gives me five numbers in the list that add up to 257, I'm going to be able to check it very quickly and say, yeah, you're right, or no, you're wrong. Okay? We also talked about Google, and Glenn talked about how Google works, and we said that what Google does is it starts in a node like, Yahoo, like a node that has a lot of, that people use a lot and that has a lot of outgoing links, and it crawls the links, it goes from link to link, and that is why in our experiment, or what was supposed to be our experiment, if you create a new word and you put it on a page that is linked to by another page, Google is going to find it. If you put it on a web page that's not linked to, that's isolated, Google is not going to be able to find it because what it does is just scrolls from link to link, and if it can't reach that web page, it's not going to be able to index that word. We also talk about graphs and how internet can be seen as a huge graph of web pages, and we talked about what it means for a node to be a source, a sink, what a path is, what a cycle is, what a connected component, and so on. When a node is reachable from another node, if you can reach it through a path, and so on. So in for a graph, I would like everybody to be able to figure out what the sources are, what the sinks are, cycle paths, what nodes are reachable from other nodes, and so on. We also talk about sorting, and because we showed how much sorting helps. If you have a problem, it's so much faster to do it on a sorted list than most of the time than an unsorted list. So how do we sort? Well, we had selection sort, bubble sort, which were big O and squared, and then we had quick sort and merge sort, which were big O and log N. And the log comes from using this binary search idea. And the binary search is searching in a sorted list, which was what we had before. So binary search said the reason why the word binary is used is because if you split it in half, there's two halves. And binary, it's not zeros and ones, but it's halves. So that takes log big O of log n. If you have a problem and you're able to split it in half at each step, that's going to give you this big O of log n kind of time. And it's very fast and efficient. Okay, and so this is with how long does it take to solve a problem on a sorted and an unsorted list? And this is kind of summarizes the same kind of summarizes each of these problems. And then we talked about Turing machines and computation, and that weird things happen when you can use self-referential statements, let's see if I have it here. You know, this statement cannot be proven, this statement. If you make references to yourself, there's all kinds of weird things happening, and we saw all kind of paradoxes. We talked about sets and how different sets have different sizes, but they're actually the same size, and some of them are bigger than others. This was a weird lecture. If they're all weird, you know, for people who they're not all weird, this was the weirdest of all of them. So we also talked about probabilities, and we talked about random bits and how randomness is very helpful in solving problems. And we also said that we talked about probabilities and how many times on average we have to repeat an event before it happens. So we said that if an event has a certain probability, p, you need 1 over p tries on average before it happens. I think this was a problem like this was in the homework, too. So, you know, I might ask a question, you know, given that you have a dice and you roll the dice, how many times on average before you get an odd number or something like that, or before you get 6. Okay, and also another skill here was the halting problem. And given a loop, what initial values of a variable make the loop halt? And we had some examples of that too. After that, we talked about encoding. And encoding is finding a shorter code for something. Compression is taking a text and trying to make the coding as small as we can. We said that the Huffman encoding is as small as possible encoding, that the best you can do with a text without losing information. Sometimes video compression is lossy. If they try to broadcast something and they have to broadcast a lot of information, sometimes they choose not to send parts of the image, so then you see this whole area that you can't see. You might have experienced that. If you have a digital TV, that happens sometimes. So in this case, I would like everybody to be able to encode, find a Huffman code for a string, or given a Huffman code, or given the tree, find how you represent a certain string or something like that. We also talked about parallel computers, and we saw that by Moore's law, the computers double in speed every year, or a year and a half or something. And then we said that we can also speed things up by making a lot of computers working at the same time on a problem. And so one example of parallel computing is Google's Map and Reduce, which says there's a task, and I'm going to send this task to 100 computers. Each computer will work on part of the data, and they're going to apply that task on part of the data. And that's how Google is able to do it so fast, because they have all these computers that work together at the same time. Michael talked about computers that learn and adapt, talks about classifiers, which are trying to, given a whole training set, given a set of students that are have been successful or unsuccessful in college, learn what are the properties, what are the features that make somebody successful, something like that. And so, given a new student, you can predict if they're going to be successful or not. And these classifiers can also be created automatically, which is kind of cool. They have decision trees. Forever loops can be useful when you're trying to make a program that keeps waiting for your input, like an operating system or a thermostat. And so sometimes forever loops are a good thing. We also probably talk about reinforcement learning and how you define the problem by defining the goals and by defining the reinforcement, and then your agent will be hopefully driven by that reinforcement. And robots are just computers. They do have sensors. They get data from the environment, and they have motors and stuff like that, and so they can act in the environment. But they're just computers that kind of process the data. And today we talked about the genetic algorithms and how they're an attempt to kind of prevent the engineering, the fact that engineering sometimes fails. And we said that if we want to design a genetic algorithm that solves the problem, all we have to do is make a random population and then test the score each individual, throw away the worst, keep the best ones, change them a little bit, and maybe use them to create new individuals and repeat that process. Eventually, we're going to reach the second best solution possible for that problem. Okay, and that's it. So see you next time. Bring all your questions next time, please.